You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
As politics, communications, and commerce are increasingly globalized, free expression can be as much an international issue as a domestic one. Even within countries with long traditions of protecting speech, there's still much debate over what should be protected and when freedoms can be justifiably restricted. In Free Speech, 10 Principles for a Connected World, historian and political commentator Timothy Garton Ash argues that free expression is critically important if we are to agree on how to disagree. It's published by Yale, and we have a link to a related website, freespeechdebate.com, on our show page. I'm very pleased that they bring Mr. Garton Ash back to our show. Welcome back.
It's great to be back.
You write about what you call the Cosmopolis. What do you mean by that?
We've never been in a world where the connected world of my title, where tendentially everyone is becoming neighbors with everybody else.
Because of the internet?
Because of the internet and mass migration. So in a city like New York, you have people from everywhere, every faith, every culture, every language. And at the same time, everyone can hear everyone else on the internet. So when you get a Charlie Hebdo or the Danish cartoons or one of the great free speech crises of our time, you know, a convicted fraudster posts a rubbishy 13-minute video called The Innocence of Muslims on YouTube, and people die in demonstrations in Pakistan and Afghanistan. A fatwa is pronounced in Raqqa, and someone may die in New York. That's the world we're in.
What can greater freedom of speech accomplish? I'm not sure if the people who commit those crimes, who do those killings, that freedom of speech is even an issue in their minds.
So look, I mean, we're talking in the country which has the greatest constitutionally anchored tradition of free speech in the world, bar none. It's obviously essential for democracy.
But that's also because in this country we had a Bill of Rights which actually made it part of the law. In Britain, for example, there is no such thing, and later maybe we'll talk about some of the things that happened there in some other countries.
So absolutely, but here's the point. In the past, we could say, when in Rome, do as the Romans do, right? You're in the US, you've got the First Amendment. You're in England, you've got common law. You're in Germany, India, China, each do it their own way. But if information, ideas, cartoons, pictures are flowing freely across frontiers on the internet, if we're all becoming neighbors, then, and this is the point of my book, Free Speech, we have to have a conversation about the rules of the road. You may allow that here, but we're going to kill people there.
And don't official restrictions vary drastically, although there seems to be a trend toward shrinking free speech in many countries around the world?
Well, so in the American tradition, you have the famous phrase, the heckler's veto. The heckler shuts somebody up.
We also had the Supreme Court and deciding that you have freedom of speech, but you can't yell fire
in a crowded theater. Absolutely so. But what we have faced now, particularly in Europe, actually, but even in the United States, is what I have called the assassin's veto. This is people saying absolutely credibly, if you say that, if you publish that, we will kill you. And sometimes they do, as in the case of the cartoonists and journalists on the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo in Paris. And I argue that that is actually having a massive chilling effect on free speech, particularly in Europe, but to some extent even in the United States. We have the phenomenon of self-censorship out of fear. So that one of my sort of guiding principles, rules of the road, is we neither make threats of violence nor accept violent intimidation. They're two sides to the coin.
A well-known Romanian writer once told me that it was when Ceausescu eliminated censorship laws that things became really dangerous.
Well, you're spot on. Look, as Orwell and Solzhenitsyn showed us, these totalitarian or post-totalitarian regimes lived by the big lie, the semantic occupation of the public sphere. I experienced that for many years in Eastern Europe. I still have a Polish censor's verdict on one of my articles from 1989. And what happened in 89 was the censorship crumbled, the big lies crumbled, and that was the beginning of the end of the regimes themselves. So all dictators, even authoritarian leaders, fear free speech.
But in the case of this writer, when censorship was eliminated, it meant that nobody knew the rules, and you were in real trouble if you crossed the wrong line. It was easier for them when they knew you couldn't say this or you could say that.
Which is what's happening in China at the moment. I have a lot in the book about China. I go there regularly. China arguably has the largest apparatus of censorship in human history, because it's a big country and there's simply, with the internet, so much more speech out there. And it operates, as Hungary used to in the 1980s, by never allowing you to see where the line is. So you don't, you never know. Maybe yesterday you were the right side of the line, but today you're the wrong side of the line. And actually there's a great case, which I quote in the book, where a very brave human rights lawyer called Puja Chang quoted New York Times versus Sullivan to defend a journalist who was exposing a corrupt official. Guess what happened? The small difference is it's the lawyer who's in jail.
And that's something that happens in China more than other countries, that the human rights lawyers are the ones who wind up going to jail. They're the ones who are supposed to be defending free speech.
Particularly at the moment. I mean, we have to recognize there is a terrible kind of Leninist crackdown going on in China. And, you know, it's kind of interesting in a larger context. You remember Bill Clinton said at the beginning of the 21st century, for China to try to control the internet would be like trying to nail jello to the wall. And you know what? The Chinese Communist Party turned around and said, Bill, just watch us. And they made a pretty good stab, I can tell you. I think they're winning at the moment.
Now, when China's economy opened up, many people predicted that that would bring more democracy and bring more free speech, because economies thrive best in an open society. Why hasn't that happened in China? Why is China moving in the opposite direction?
Listen, their version of WeChat, of WhatsApp, which is called Weixin WeChat, is actually better than WhatsApp, dare I say. They have the capacity. They're very inventive, entrepreneurial people. The question is, but that's copying and making better, rather like Japanese cars, okay. The question is, as their economy develops and matures, can they get the innovation, the creative storm of destruction, the stuff you see in Silicon Valley, unless they have more freedom of expression? And I think that's something the Chinese Communist Party is worrying about a lot, because they need to censorship to keep political control. But what if they need free speech for innovation to keep the economy growing?
So how do they work that out?
Well, at the moment,
obviously they're doing something that's kind of self-defeating.
Well, you know, I used to think my sort of long experience of Leninism was a wasting asset. But actually, we're right back with Comrade Lenin. Xi Jinping is making the Leninist gamble that you can run everything by the centralized party state. And I don't think it's going to work in the long term. But in the short term, obviously, you know, if you can lock up enough people, you can make it work.
I'm speaking with Timothy Garton Ash, whose latest book is Free Speech, 10 Principles for a Connected World. And you talked about your time in Poland. Isn't Poland one of the European countries where freedom of speech has suffered the most setbacks in recent years? So, also Hungary.
So this is a real shocker. I mean, here are these places who only a quarter century ago had very oppressive regimes, and everybody celebrated the arrival of free speech, and now it's been reimposed by the governments themselves. Hungary is a sort of hybrid, almost an authoritarian state. But Poland, which has been a tremendous success and an incredibly vibrant place, you have a new government, populist, Catholic nationalist populist government, which is already massively controlling the public service media. It's been renamed national media, which is always a bad sign. And that is extremely worrying, and I'm afraid it has something in common with the Brexit movement in Britain, with Marine Le Pen of the National Front in France, and with Donald Trump in this country. It's all the same populist rhetoric which appeals to the people as a supreme authority. Never mind constitutional courts, never mind minority protections, the people must speak.
Angela Merkel is also under attack in the same way. in Germany.
Angela Merkel, whom I greatly admire, is an embattled lighthouse with the storm waves coming higher and higher around her. She's losing her allies left, right and centre. Britain is going, Poland has gone, France is weak. But she's also facing large waves in her own country in reaction to the flow of refugees.
Haven't some countries referred to the Obama administration's prosecution of whistleblowers to justify their crackdowns on speech?
So, as you know, Edward Snowden is a European hero. There have been moves to give him German citizenship. There's a petition to ask for a presidential pardon. I think there is a real problem in the attitude of the Obama administration, which says the guy's actually performed a public service, it's really important we have this debate, but he should be tried for treason, right? You know, I mean, in my Christian childhood, we were taught that you should hate the sin but love the sinner. And as I say in the book, the U.S., you know, Washington's approach seems to be the very opposite. You love the sin but hate the sinner. I actually think Snowden has mentioned that he would be open to a plea bargain. I mean, I just don't think it's realistic politics that he'll get a pardon, you know, heavens above. I just don't think that would fly. But I think actually a plea bargain with a short sentence, that would be just great.
Are you surprised by the mixed response he's received in the American press? How is speech doing in actual practice? How effectively are we using the freedoms we have on hand? How are specialists in expressions, journalists, academics, writers, and others doing in this regard?
Well, look, it's still the greatest free speech society on earth. I have no doubts about that. But I think there is something somewhat worrying, which has happened, in my view, particularly since 9/11, about the last 15 years, which, understandably, the country was traumatized by these terrorist attacks. There was a great solidarity, but it has had the effect of making people too deferential whenever national security is invoked. I mean, national security is all over the world played as a trump card. And, for example, the New York Times, in my view, is just much too deferential in its reporting on national security.
And the Bush administration went to the New York Times at the time in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq and said, please don't publish certain things, and they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think the story is complicated, to be fair, because there are still some great, you know, national security reporters on the Post and the Times, but it is interesting that the Snowden revelations were essentially broken by The Guardian and only subsequently by The New York Times. And in a way, you know, dare I say, because I write for The Guardian has become that sort of more campaigning liberal paper that actually The Post and The Times used to be at the time of Watergate and the Vietnam War.
Timothy Garton Ash is my guest. He is the prize-winning author of 9 previous books on political writing, including The Magic Lantern, The File, and most recently, Facts Are Subversive. He is also Isaiah Berlin Professorial Fellow at St. Anthony's College, University of Oxford, and has all sorts of other posts in Britain. His latest book is Free Speech, 10 Principles for a Connected World. It's published by Yale University Press. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Timothy Garton Ash, whose latest book is Free Speech, 10 Principles for a Connected World. It's published by Yale University Press. You helped to launch a project called Free Speech Debate. What's it trying to do?
So I was sitting there in Stanford, writing about what I call the post-Gutenberg world, because clearly this is a revolution, you know, second only to the invention of printing. And I suddenly thought to myself, well, what the hell are you doing writing an old-fashioned Gutenberg book when you're writing about the post-Gutenberg world and you're sitting in the middle of Silicon Valley where all this stuff is happening? So I launched at Oxford this big research project, at the heart of which is a website called freespeechdebate.com. Please go and have a look. It's in 13 languages. It has case studies, stories, arguments from all over the world, because, you know, our free speech debates are so much centered on the West, America and Europe, and amazing cases from China, India, Russia, Latin America, you name it. And it's been fascinating because the biggest interest in free speech, I have found, comes from China. Then it's Iran, then it's Russia, the Arab world. America brings up the rear. So the less free speech you have, the more you want it.
In fact, just today's news of an activist for women's rights in Iran being arrested once again. She spent many years in and out of jails.
Yeah, I mean, authoritarian regimes are desperately trying to hold off freedom of expression as they always had. I had this experience in China. You may remember I wrote a book about the strange experience of reading my own Stasi file, a book called The File. Amazingly, this has been published in China by an incredibly adventurous liberal publisher who convinced the censors, ancient European history, nothing to do with China, you know, Stasi. We did an online live chat, so the questions were coming up in real time. In front of our eyes, I tell the story in the book, in front of our eyes, some of the questions were disappearing because the in-house censor was taking them down in real time, but still they came. The Berlin Wall has come down. When will the Great Firewall of China come down? So you see that battle going on literally every minute, every second on the Internet.
The 10 principles you have on freespeechdebate.com and in this book are under the headings. Some of them will be immediately obvious, some less so. Lifeblood, violence, knowledge, journalism, diversity, religion, privacy, secrecy, icebergs, and courage. What are the principles for? Are some more important than others?
So here we are living in this connected world, which I call Cosmopolis. It's really like living in one enormous city with 4 billion inhabitants. We all come from our different cultural, constitutional, legal traditions. We all have different terms for things. What this tries to do, and it came out of this great transnational and transcultural debate, is to set out a very simple, stripped down to essential set of liberal principles. So the wording is as simple, as plain, as easily comprehensible as possible on all the key areas for free speech, right? And these are then translated into all those languages. So it actually works in Chinese or Urdu or Farsi. So to give you, I mean, I mentioned the one on violence. You know, we all say this in our own national traditions, right? Fighting words in the US tradition. But this says it very, very simply. We neither make threats of violence nor accept violent intimidation. On religion, we respect the believer, but not necessarily the content of the belief. Discuss. And then off we go.
Well, violence of the sort that we saw with the Charlie Hebdo killings, we understand, but violence can apply to everyone, governments, corporations, individuals. In practice, doesn't it have very different implications depending on the subject, the situation?
So in Europe, it is particularly violent Islamist extremists. I mean, that's a big threat to us. But if you're Roberto Saviano, the wonderful Italian journalist, it's the Italian mafia who are forcing you to hide 24/7 with armed guards, living a hellish life. So that's absolutely right. And, you know, in India, it could be Hindus, nationalists.
And in Mexico, it can be drug cartels.
It's the drug gangs, absolutely. So that's why I put the focus, and I think this is quite important. It's not, quote-unquote, Islam that is. It's the threat of violence which has to be resisted. We have to face down the assassin's veto. Now, governments, absolutely, of course, in many places, it's the government going to bump you off. I mean, if you think of the great Russian journalist, Anna Politkovskaya, you know, it's people doubtless somehow connected, let me put it cautiously, to the Putin regime. I mean, Putin's critics do have a habit of getting shot or knifed, you know. In the United States, I don't think that's the biggest problem. I think in the United States, actually, the biggest problem is the outsized role that money plays, particularly after Citizens United, that money speaks, money howls through American politics.
But we do have a fair amount of violence here. We had the Oklahoma office building bombing. We've had people shooting up all sorts of different places, nightclubs and the like, all to make some kind of a point.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to squelch free speech.
No, absolutely you do.
Shooting abortion doctors.
So let's take the recent bombings in New York and New Jersey, right? Because that's a great case. This is a guy who is being radicalized online, okay? So at least in part online, although he also traveled to majority Muslim countries. And so that raises a really big question, which is quite central to this book. It's not just about the states and the governments. What we have at the moment is what I call private superpowers. Google, Facebook, Twitter, Amazon, Apple. You know, if Facebook were a country, it'd be the largest country on earth, 1.7 billion regular users. And there's a really interesting question about what their responsibility is, because they're hosting a lot of this stuff.
And we expect them to restrict some speech.
Like, for example, child pornography, pedophilia, which they proactively go after, as well as that which is illegal in the United States. But, you know, now the interior ministries in Europe, and I think in this country too, are coming to them and saying, are you really telling us that terrorism is not as great an evil as pedophile child pornography? But, of course, that's a very slippery slope.
Well, in Europe, we have all sorts of other situations. Britain always has had loose libel laws. It has had the Official Secrets Act. Recently, it was proposed that pornography in general be censored on the internet. Germany has banned neo-Nazi organizations. France has banned Holocaust denial and headscarves. Is there any effort to establish international standards of what should be protected and
well,
what can't?
Well, this is why I hope this book is a blow for free speech in the sense of questioning what is a very gradual slice-by-slice, salami-slicing of free speech in Europe in all the ways you've described. Tear off your burkini. Really, you know, dress is also a form of self-expression. And obviously we have laws against sort of people running stalkers down the street and so on.
Well, a burkini is the opposite of running down the street.
It is the opposite, as if the Enlightenment did not demand that we should tear off our scarves or T-shirts, you know, and the spectacle of police standing over a woman forcing her to take off her burkini, as if France did not have really serious problems with its Muslim population. I mean, they sure do. So this is where a wider debate, is so important. I myself am actually much more on the First Amendment position on hate speech. I think hate speech should be combated very vigorously by counter speech. I think the record of hate speech laws in Europe of trying to enforce civility is actually a very poor one. There are more racist chants at French soccer matches than I've ever heard at American football matches.
My guest is Timothy Garton Ash. His latest book, Free Speech, 10 Principles for a Connected World, published by Yale University Press. One of the political issues recently here has been political correctness. Facebook and before it AOL had been widely criticized for discussions and representations of women's breasts, even when the discussion might be about cancer.
So political correctness.
And then we have this whole issue now about the trigger warnings and the debate over whether they should be allowed or not.
Yeah, I think political correctness, quote-unquote, has become a bit of a campaign slogan. I noticed at the Republican convention, almost every speaker just attacked political correctness and Pavlovian reaction, blah, 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 clap, clap, clap. You know, if political correctness means when you're advertising a job you say he or she, I'm for it, right? If it means not using the N-word, I'm for it. If it means you don't talk Joseph Conrad's, and I am going to give the title because it's the title of a historic novel, The Nigger of the Narcissus, then I'm against it because this is history, this is literature, right?
So and that word also appears on rap records.
And as I say in the book, it appears also, it was used by Martin Luther King, so you're not going to teach the writings of Martin Luther King. I am very worried by what's happening in universities. You know, when I set out 10 years ago to work on this book at Oxford and Stanford, I never imagined that free speech would be under threat in the university itself. We should not be too hysterical about this. I mean, if a trigger warning just means I'm using really graphic material about, say, rape. I just warned my class, there's some graphic material coming up. That's fine. What is never, never acceptable is disinviting people, so-called no-platforming. You know, we've had ridiculous cases in Britain where, for example, the radical feminist, famous feminist Germaine Greer was disinvited from a British university because of her views on transgender people. That is student-on-student censorship. And a university is the last place in the world where we should have censorship.
Most people in the United States or Europe recognize some legitimate restrictions on speech. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that my guests can't say certain words on the radio or on television. How can we decide what restrictions are appropriate? Don't some people advocate total freedom from restriction?
So listen, the oldest canard, the oldest straw man in the shop is the idea that free speech means totally unlimited speech, global logorrhea. No serious First Amendment person believes that. So the argument is about what are legitimate restrictions by law on free speech, but that's only half the argument. I say there are two questions, not just one. One is, how free should speech be? The other is, how should free speech be? And at best, what we have, I mean, for example, on NPR or in The Guardian or wherever it might be, or in a university or in a parliament, is what I call robust civility, where saying everything that needs to be said, but doing it in a way which opens out and doesn't shut down the debate.
Most people argue that the internet would have a democratizing influence, that information wants to be free. But what's happened in practice?
So this is true of all technologies. It's like a knife. You can use your knife to cut your sandwich, or you can use your knife to stab someone. And the same is true of the internet. It has a massive liberating potential. Never have we been able to speak so directly to so many other people. It also gives the potential for mass surveillance, both by the NSA, but also by the big internet platforms, beyond Stasi General's wildest dreams.
And job seekers have to be concerned that something on their Facebook page might come back to haunt them.
Exactly. So I think that we have all to learn how to navigate these new high seas that we suddenly find ourselves on. But I argue very strongly that we should limit as little as possible by law, focus on violence, focus on the real problems, and work it out ourselves.
In a review of your book, Edmund Fawcett claims that free speech hunts out truth and spreads knowledge. What does current social science say about that?
That's a very interesting question, because, you know, the classic, actually, English argument for free speech, John Milton, John Stuart Mill, was it helps you to get at the truth, the best search engine. Now, I still believe that is fundamentally true, but if you look at the way the internet works, because of the sheer profusion of sources, we all know we're getting an echo chamber effect, and people are finding sites, you know, Breitbart would be one example, but there are others on the left or in other directions.
People seek out people who agree with them.
Exactly, and reinforce their prejudices. And I think one actually sees that in the current presidential election here. And that is very worrying, because the essential idea of free speech for democratic self-government is what you saw in ancient Athens. The citizens gather in the assembly. Everyone can hear everyone else.
Several politicians who have been on the show have attributed declining civility in Congress to less direct interaction. Elected officials are too busy raising money and talking to the people who agree with them. Do we need to change how people interact? I mean, can we even do that sort of thing?
So I think there is you know, the great and noble American cliche is the marketplace of ideas. And I think if you look at the way, for example, in this president election campaign, Trump supporters and Clinton supporters are almost separating out into their separate echo chambers. We watch Fox News, look at Breitbart, listen to Rush Limbaugh. We read the New York Times, listen to MSNBC, and dare I say NPR. I would say there is almost a market failure in the marketplace of ideas. And what we're seeing is the erosion of the public square. So I think we really have to think about how we get the public square back.
Isn't the goal healthy speech, the kind of speech that supports a healthy democracy as opposed to certain candidate speech?
I'd be very wary with words like healthy. You know, who decides? Am I the doctor? Are you the doctor? Is Breitbart the doctor? But what is important, what is absolutely crucial to the whole idea, is that we're all there together in the public sphere, public square, listening to each other with robust civility.
Well, I am reluctant to have two people come on the show who totally disagree that kind of he said, she said conversation, because they kind of just equal each other or they cancel each other out. But I was thinking about the debate. Was there any debating there? Isn't debating supposed to be the sort of thing where we have an open discussion and hear real expressions of ideas? Is that what we just saw on Monday?
Of course, they were both speaking to their base, trying to target particular parts of the electorate.
But was that a debate?
It was a presidential candidate's debate, which is a particular, you know, it wasn't... you know, the greatest days of the British Parliament, shall we say. That's for sure. But no, there were some real exchanges about policy, and it's a hell of a lot better than everybody just sticking in their own echo chamber. I do agree with you about the ding-dong. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful, Brooke Gladstone of this parish has a wonderful phrase when she talks about fairness bias. Oh, Professor Jones, you argue that the earth is round. That's very interesting. Now, Mr. Smith, tell us why the earth is flat. Mm-hmm. You know...
I've seen that way too often. On the other hand, I do believe that it's important to have people of different opinions on to talk about their ideas individually. And then in the end, the debate is in the listener's mind.
Yes, I do agree with that. But I do think, and there's been some discussion of this, and you do it yourself, I do think there is an important role for the moderator in challenging them and also challenging them when they deliver complete whoppers.
And then I have listeners who complain that I challenge the person that they support.
And by the way, apropos of Greek and American democracies, listeners are great in this context. I mean, we have a lovely program on called Question Time on BBC television, where it's the listeners who are selected. So they're Conservative, Labour, and Liberal, and so on. It's the listeners who are the interviewers, and that's terrific.
Well, I hope that idea doesn't catch on here. I need this job. Timothy Garton Ash, his latest book is Free Speech, 10 Principles for a Connected World, published by Yale University Press. It's always a pleasure having you on our show.
Real pleasure.